I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, Stone Mountain. My guests today are cultural geographer John Allensworth, Paul Hudson, author of Atlanta's Stone Mountain, A Multicultural History, and Jay Davis, birder and board member at Atlanta Audubon Society. We're here to talk about Stone Mountain.
Oh, okay, good.
You know a little bit about that,
I know
you?
A little bit about Stone Mountain. I live out that way. I've been trying to learn more about it since I've moved to Atlanta, actually. I've been here closing in on 20 years. My name is John Allensworth. I am a geographer by profession. I taught at Kent State University for 30 years and then also taught at Georgia State. I think people think that geography is just knowing countries and capitals, rivers and streams, mountains and coves. The reality is it's a very complex field that is both physical, that is, that we take a look at the natural environment and the human relationship with that. But we also take a look at the cultural environment as well.
And what is cultural geography?
Cultural geography basically looks at people and systems and how they organize their space, whether it's residential neighborhoods, economic systems, everything that we see around us basically is a part of our geographic or our cultural geography, so to speak, because they've been created by us. Every tree that you see, if it wasn't planted, at least it was left there by someone. It was not cut down. So that whole landscape is essentially a reflection of our culture.
Well, one very large component to our conversation today is some geography that doesn't look like it's changing anytime soon, which would be Stone Mountain.
Well, Stone Mountain. Stone Mountain actually, though, is that it has changed. I mean, the reality, and it depends on how we're looking at it. And if we're just looking at it as a physical structure, no, it hasn't changed. Actually, it's slowly changing. If we had unlimited time, we would see dramatic change. But from our perspective, it looks very static.
What would we see?
Well, what we would see is that the mountain itself would possibly decrease in terms of its size. You have to kind of think that the granite of that mountain is a bit like the layers of an onion. It peels away, exfoliation. And so the external forces are beginning to very slowly wear the mountain away. Now, if, you know, we might find in certain situations in time, the pressures that might exist within the earth itself could lift it up again. It actually was in part lifted, but it was created within the earth itself. And as the earth, the surface began to wear away, it was thus exposed. So that process continues. I mean, that process is there, but we're looking at millions of years. We're not necessarily talking about next week.
You had started to talk about the changes in geography as related to cultural changes at Stone Mountain, which there definitely have been. Many. Can you kind of give your take on where it came from and where you think we are today?
In terms of the cultural impact that the mountain has had? Well, it's always had, ever since, at least from the Europeans' perspective, for when European settlers came into the area, they had reported about seeing this very strange mountain standing up all by itself in the middle of nowhere. Some thought that it possessed great riches. The Spanish expeditions were hoping that it was a mountain of diamonds because it sparkled. So that attracted interest. A lot of Europeans misrepresented it, thought that it was perhaps an archaeological site, that it was like one of the great Mayan pyramids. But we know that even before the Europeans, the Native American population had that as probably a ritual center. We can see that, or at least early reports were that There was kind of a walled ring at the surface some indication that it might have been used not as a habitation site, but instead maybe more as some kind of spiritual site. So it's played a role in terms of the people that have come in contact with it, because it is a feature, this essentially barren rock, essentially extending up, not quite a mountain. We call it a mountain, but it has less than 800 feet of relief. That is the distance from base to surface. And so it's definitely had impact. There's no question that people who live in this area or people who came in contact with it looked at it in a very special way. It was not like any of the other structures, and it isn't. It's a monadnock. A monadnock is a landform that rises up out of a relatively flat surface.
Is granite everywhere in Atlanta, or is this just like this amazing outcropping?
Well, there's quite Atlanta has... is underlined with quite a bit of granite. I mean, now when we talk about Atlanta, I mean, we're looking at the metro region.
Right.
We also have metamorphosed granite, a rock called gneiss, G-N-E-I-S-S. It's not, it's nice rock when I say that, but that's the name of it is gneiss, German word, which would be a very hard rock if you go to the Peachtree Center MARTA station. It's the deepest of the stations within the MARTA system, and they've left the rocks exposed in that station so that we can see this rock. And so its original form was the igneous granite, but it was metamorphosed and went through a process of pressure and heating to actually change its structure. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, you know, it was quarried by hand. I mean, they sawed, huge chunks of granite from that mountain. I guess it would be over on the east side of the mountain, basically, is the quarry. I don't know. Have you been to the quarry?
I have not.
Yeah, you should go.
I think quarries are cool, though.
Yeah, they had quarried that, the granite from that. The granite has been used for a lot of post offices within the United States. We use Stone Mountain granite, built a lot of WPA project buildings, the locks of the Panama Canal, the Imperial Hotel, the old Imperial Hotel in Tokyo was built from Stone Mountain granite. So it had a commercial use. And so I don't want to say that it was easily cut, but it's easy to work with. It's hard. What makes it nice is that it is, if you do it correctly, I mean, you can quarry it, you can shape blocks out of it, etc. But it is hard.
But does it surprise you that there are seemingly thousands of initials carved into this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that was people wanted to say, I was here. People, some of the interesting ones, people actually carved out the shape of what they might call their tombstone and put their initials in it. Union troops who were billeted in that area got great pleasure out of going out and putting their initials on it so they could go back to Ohio or Minnesota or Michigan and tell their family, yes, I have my initials on Stone Mountain, because everybody had heard of Stone Mountain. I mean, it was a famous place in 1865.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Stone Mountain, brought to you by Perkins & Will.
You know that Rocky Mountain. Tell me it's way out anywhere. Oh, Rocky Mountain. Tell me it's way out anywhere.
Woo! There's all kinds of crazy facts about Stone Mountain. And a lot of them revolve around the relief carving of three Confederate heroes and their horses. It's crazy to think that Jefferson Davis's thumb is the size of a sofa.
So the artistry, this is mountain sculpture. Now, everybody feels different about mountain sculpture. I mean, the Indians thought it was beautiful, you know, for centuries. It's just a plain mountain as it is with those scars. Those scars are from prehistory when it was a rock underground. But But the carving, and it makes Stone Mountain, it kind of fulfills its objective, a permanent memorial to the Confederacy, permanent. My name is Paul Hudson. I teach history at Georgia Perimeter College. I'm also a writer, and I've written a book on Stone Mountain with my collaborator, Laura Mirza. The book is called Atlanta's Stone Mountain, A Multicultural History. If you know where the walk-up trail begins, kind of a landmark is the the Confederate flag terrace done by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Because the Confederacy, and this is history, had a series of flags. One of them was so white it looked like a surrender flag. But the most familiar one is, you know, they call the Confederate battle flag, the red one with the cross of St. Andrew. But it's interesting, you know, when you go up the mountain and you go down, and coming down, you have to be careful. It's a little slippery sometimes. But one time when I was coming down, there were some African-Americans. And, of course, they were young men, and they were taking pictures of this and that. But they saw that it was a windy day, and those Confederate flags were blowing. And one said, take a picture of that. And the other said, no, I don't want to take a picture of Confederate flags. And the other said, come on, man, you just take the good with the bad. He said, well, all right, we'll take a picture of it. But a lot of people, you know, they're really indulgent, I think, of this Confederate memorial. But I think a lot of times it just escapes them.
Well, I don't know if you can really separate the two, but let's do for the moment and talk about just the artistry and technique that had to go into carving something that big and precise.
Oh, yeah. I would say that carving is epic. It was conceived by one of the great sculptors, Gutzon Borglum. He later went on to do Mount Rushmore. And so, as you study, originally, he had this idea of a Confederate army galloping around Stone Mountain. And then that didn't work. The Klan, Ku Klux Klan, they're just circumstantial links. It really wasn't the Klan, but the Klan loved the carving. You got to be clear on that. But then there was another sculptor, and these were all sculptors. Borglum, the one who envisioned, he studied under Auguste Rodin. And then the next sculptor, Augustus Luckman, studied under Daniel Chester French, you know, the Lincoln Memorial. And so they're really first-rate sculptors, but he had the one that we see now. It was his vision. It wasn't galloping. It was calm. What those three Confederate heroes are doing is they're waiting for the colors, the flag to come by, and so they have their hats over their chest. One of them does. And do you know who the three main individuals are, you know, carved onto Stone Mountain?
Is it Andrew Jackson?
It's Stonewall Jackson. They're all Confederate heroes.
Okay.
Leading is Jefferson Davis.
Jefferson Davis.
The president of the Confederacy. In the middle is Robert E. Lee, you know, big icon for the Confederacy. And in the back is Stonewall Jackson. And they're all astride horses. Blackjack is the first horse on Jefferson Davis. Lee, Traveler, his favorite steed. And then Stonewall Jackson was on a horse called Fancy or Little Sorrel, depending. The one who really finished it, and it was to be finished during the time of the centennial, 1961 to 1965. It really, like anything, ran behind schedule in 1970. But his name was Walker Hancock, and he finished the stone. We call it the Confederate Memorial carving. There's different names.
Well, like you said, I mean, I don't see Stone Mountain going anywhere anytime soon, but I think it's great that it's progressing from a social standpoint.
Oh, you could see the progress right at the end of the carving, because it's 1970. I mean, things had changed so much in 1970. And the Civil Rights Act had been passed. There was no longer segregated picnic facilities. And they had invited the Reverend Billy Graham to give the invocation, but he was ill. And the Stone Mountain Memorial Association, they're the ones who really run Stone Mountain in the end. It's a state agency, but no state funds. It's paid by those annual passes that you and I have, you know, to go to Stone Mountain Park. But they invited one of the great black preachers. His name was William Holmes Borders. And so he gave the invocation. Here's a black man breaking the color line, 1970, to dedicate the Stone Mountain Memorial carving.
Now, is this fact or fiction? In the pools at the top, are there shrimp in them?
The rock pools, yeah. You're in the Stone Mountain cult, I can tell.
Jane. I like the trivia.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of... There is a mountaintop habitat. Of course, it's very austere, and that water, you know, collects... Imagine a lot of it is collected this summer of 2013.
Oh, my God.
We had so much rain. And so those pools, yeah, there are these little shrimp, and there's these different things called warts, black wart and things like that, but that do gather in these mountains. And that's, by the way, have you ever wondered why trees could grow on Stone Mountain?
I'd like to know.
Well, that's called succession, and in these, eventually water makes these pools very deep, and then dust blows into them, and then over the course of centuries, pine trees, you know, scrub pines, they're like Shetland ponies are to horses or something. They're these little tough trees that that grow, but you see trees growing on Stone Mountain. It has a real environment. It is granite, but there is dirt that settles into those rock pools. But the park was created in 1958, and then the big question is, what would Stone Mountain be? Because it could have gone a commercial route, and there was a place being built in Atlanta, Six Flags, in Douglasville area. And so there was the fear that Stone Mountain would be Six Flags East. And so, but what's marvelous about Stone Mountain is it has this great master plan, and about 60% of it is natural. And I think under the circumstances, that's really good.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Stone Mountain.
It's one of the jokes among us birders is you have to be careful when you're talking to a birder because you never know when they're going to say, "Did you hear that, Cardinal?" Point up to the left, you know. Hi, I'm Jay Davis. I'm a board member for Atlanta Audubon Society. And probably our primary focus is giving people opportunity to learn about birds firsthand, giving people experiences with birds, you know, around the metro Atlanta area.
Sure. And, I mean, yeah. Atlanta is also known as city in a forest.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you have a lot of opportunities, but I got to tell you, I was a little bit surprised to learn that Stone Mountain, one of the biggest non-green spaces, is actually a great place to bird watch.
It is, actually. They have a small portion of the park that I think was the archery and cycling venue for the 1996 Olympics, that once that was over, they converted it into a bird park, and it's called the Songbird Habitat Trail. It's a great opportunity to see birds that you wouldn't normally see in a lot of places around the Atlanta area.
What, like what?
Like indigo buntings, which are a bright blue bird that can be very conspicuous. They like to get on tops of trees and sing over and over again, so you can't miss them. So they're really neat birds to see, partly because they're beautiful, but also because you don't get to see them in too many places around, in the city at least. And what's interesting is probably the top bird watching place in the metro Atlanta area is Kennesaw Mountain. There's lots of theories as to why it's the top place, but partly just the altitude of it. And when birds, particularly in the spring, when birds are migrating, birds kind of take a circular route in their migration patterns, and they a lot of times will go down the coast and then fly over Cuba towards South America in the fall. But in the spring, they come up through Texas and then kind of spread out in a big fan pattern and go right through the Atlanta area as part of that. So we get a lot of birds in the migration season in the spring.
It's unbelievable.
It is incredible. You'd never see, never imagine existed. Bright yellow, bright orange, bright blue. One neat thing about being a bird watcher is you're kind of tuned into the seasons. And I think bird watchers really anticipate the spring like no other group probably, because we know all those little bright colored warblers are going to come through, and we're going to be able to see them here in Atlanta for a month or 6 weeks. And a similar thing happens in the fall. They go back, they're going back south. We don't get as many in the fall, but we do get a nice mix. And then you have different birds that arrive in the winter to spend the winter here, and different birds that stay here in the summer. It puts you in touch with all that, yeah.
Let's talk, if you know a couple of the others, talk about some of the ones that you can see at Stone Mountain.
Yeah, I was out there last weekend. So the ones that I noticed that were particularly interesting to me were the blue grosbeak, which is it's blue with brown wings and has a large beak like a finch, so it can crack seeds, and it's a field kind of bird that eats seeds mostly. A gray catbird was another one I saw last weekend.
What is that?
It's, you probably have heard the sound of it. It sounds kind of like a cat. They go, eh, eh, eh. And then they make all kinds of other sounds too, but when you hear that particular part of their sounds, you say, oh, that's a catbird. They're a gray bird with a black cap, and they have a brown or rufous color underneath their tail. Eastern Phoebe is another bird. Phoebe is kind of a brownish bird, not real distinctive, but it says its name. It goes, Phoebe, Phoebe, Phoebe.
How does someone get involved with you all with birding?
Atlanta Audubon Society leads bird walks all over the city, and we usually have at least a dozen every month. In the spring and fall, we'll have 20 or 30 bird walks. So just go to our website, AtlantaAudubonSociety.org, click on field trips, and you can see, you know, where we're leading a walk. But there is relatively regular bird walk at Stone Mountain that's led by Chris Showalter, who was an ornithologist and scientist at the Fernbank Science Center for a long time, and he's a fantastic bird leader, and so I encourage you to check out, you know, when he's leading a walk and go out there.
I'd like to thank my guests today, John Allensworth, Paul Hudson, and Jay Davis. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next month.